Hi, everybody.
Hello.
How we doing?
Hi, doctor.
So, I thought this was going to be a panel, so I guess it's just me. So I'll debate myself. The Shermer guy is right. Okay. I concede the points. I am Michael Shermer, the director of the Skeptic Society and the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, and we ran out of our 9/11 conspiracy issues, so I'm sorry. Some of you may already have it, but our booth is just right over where the booths are, and so we have other copies of Skeptic, but that particular one, I thought I brought plenty, but I guess it's a popular subject. Well, it is a popular subject, and so I guess I'll just talk briefly about the magazine and what we do, and then focus more specifically on conspiracy theories and then the 9/11 one. We are a science magazine. Skeptic is published quarterly. It's part of the Skeptic Society. We're based out of Caltech in Pasadena, and we investigate claims of the paranormal and pseudoscience, fringe groups, cults, and claims of all kinds between science and pseudoscience, junk science, voodoo science, pathological science, non-science, and plain old nonsense. And as you probably know, there's a lot of it out there, and that's kind of our job. Wherever there's a hook to get at a scientific explanation or resolving some kind of debate through science or reason, something like that, that's sort of our bailiwick. And conspiracy theories come into it through sort of different angles, not just science, but also through the sort of revision of history and reconstructing what really happened. And it involves a lot of human memory and how flawed that is, and then also the politics that's usually behind these kinds of claims. Anyway, so we've dealt with a lot of these things. We did a whole issue on JFK. Was there an assassination of Kennedy? That sort of thing. And this was prompted in part by Oliver Stone's film, and then, but also Gerald Posner's book Case Closed, which, well, in my opinion, closed the case that it was a lone assassin. And then, anyway, these kinds of things in terms of conspiracy theories, it's not that they can't be true, unlike, say, perpetual motion machines, which we don't even bother dealing with anymore, because they can't be true. They would simply violate laws of physics, so what's the bother after you've blown up a few machines that don't work in your backyard? There's not much point in it. Even the patent office doesn't accept patents for perpetual motion machines. But conspiracy theories, they can be true, because conspiracies do happen. By contrast with Kennedy, say, Lincoln was assassinated by a conspiracy. So conspiracy is just two or more people conspiring to do something against a third party without their knowledge. So obviously that can and does happen. Say the Gulf of Tonkin incident with Johnson's administration trying to maneuver politically through a difficult time in the Vietnam War, something like that. So these are – thank you. My rescuer has arrived. So these are the sorts of things you have to take case by case. About 6 months after 9/11, there was a French book that came out on this idea that the Bush administration orchestrated, or at least was a part of or knew about 9/11, that I never imagined that this would take off in America, and yet it did. It was translated, and then other people started coming out with books. And so my first encounter of this was on a book tour for a different book, and somebody, sort of a Michael Moore-ish type filmmaker, sort of approached me and wanted to talk to me about 9/11, and I didn't know what the claims were at the time. So now, since then, I pretty much know what all their claims are. And so what we try to do with Skeptic is not just debunk, but explain. I mean, here's the claim that's made, here's the explanation for it, here's the claim, here's the explanation. And or where there's no explanation, say that there's no explanation. So in the case of 9/11, it reminds me very much of Pearl Harbor conspiracy theories, which we had also dealt with in an issue of Skeptic in the early to mid-90s, when there was a book out about that, claiming that Roosevelt and Churchill both knew. And it's really easy after the fact to pick through the literature of the time and find all the little memos or letters or telegrams or whatever that seem to fit the particular theory you want to promote, and simply ignore all the others. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the Pearl Harbor conspiracy theories. And it's one in particular claim that he had discovered actual memos, intelligence reports showing that the Japanese might attack Pearl Harbor, might attack Hawaii. And that's true. They exist. Until you look at the larger body of evidence that shows there were thousands of memos in 1939, 1940, and into 41, warning people all over the Pacific. The Japanese might attack here, they might attack there, and so on. Be prepared and whatnot. So it's easy to pick the ones after the fact where you know, we already know what happened. And go, well, okay, why didn't they know? Because look, it says right here. And the similar thing happened, actually irrespective of 9/11 conspiracy theories, when the attacks on Bush in late 2001 and early 2002, that he should have known because of the memo in August that Condoleezza Rice was given, that Osama bin Laden intends to attack the United States. Yes, okay, well, that's true. Why didn't they do something about that? Because they were in the same position the rest of us were, and that is there were hundreds of or thousands of intelligence memos about all sorts of things that could happen to violate our security. So after the fact, it's easy to see, oh, that's what they did, so now let's go looking for the paper trail, and you can find that. In cognitive studies, this is called the confirmation bias, where you look for and find confirmatory evidence for what you already believe, and you ignore the disconfirmatory evidence. Everybody does it. It's just a normal, natural thing to do. The difference is in science, you're not allowed to do that, or at least if you do it, you have to catch yourself, or hopefully your colleagues will catch you before you put it in print, and then are embarrassed later when your colleagues expose your own confirmation bias. In other words, if you don't do it, somebody else will, usually with great glee in a public forum, because science is a pretty tough-skinned, competitive enterprise, and it's a good thing, too. That's what pushes it forward. That's how we make progress in science, is by skeptics and challenging each other and so on. So there's nothing wrong with promoting things like conspiracy theories. It's just a matter of how is the methodology done and how are the theories revised when new evidence comes in. And that's usually where you see the difference between objective history or so-called objective history and then conspiratorial history. So in the case of the specifics on 9/11, so this was the confirmation bias with I think in some ways unfairly critiquing the Bush administration for this hindsight bias, that in hindsight we know what they should have done. Okay, well, that's easy when you already know. After that then began the sort of slow buildup of conspiracy theorizing, largely through the internet, and so this is kind of a new phenomenon for us to track as a popular magazine, of how easy it is for anybody to make a movie now. And so you can construct with just basic Apple Macintosh software, you can make movies, and that's what a couple of these young men did in creating the famous, now famous movie Loose Change. So if you want the definitive, I guess, all-encompassing everything in one basket conspiracy theory for 9/11, you just Google Loose Change and you can watch it. It's in its, I think, third edition now, and so they keep adding on to it. It's one of the beauties of internet. You can edit and modify as you go, like on Wikipedia. So that's a good thing, but when you actually check the facts that they present there, it turns out most of them are just simply not true. And so you can string together a bunch of things that lead you at the end to say, gosh, if only half of these things are true, then clearly Bush knew and Cheney was involved or whatever. But when you look into them, it turns out that virtually none of them are true. And that's where the whole thing then falls apart. And of course, when explanations are given, they don't modify their original claims. And this is one of the telltale signs of the difference between science and pseudoscience. Digress for just a moment, that in science, the scientists may reluctantly change their mind, or they may begrudgingly do it because they're human and they're committed to their beliefs. But if they don't do it, they're just not participating in the scientific process anymore. That is, when your colleagues show you you're wrong, they run your experiment exactly as you did it, and they get completely different results. If they don't get the same results, you have to respond. You can't just ignore it and keep repeating what you believe to be true. You just can't do it. If you could do it, but you'll simply be ignored. You won't be invited to the conferences anymore. Your papers won't be accepted. And this is the case, say, with Michael Behe and intelligent design. he wrote this book, Darwin's Black Box, in which he presented half a dozen different oddities and mysteries that he didn't think evolutionary biologists could explain. Well, then within 2 years, there was a slew of books and papers saying, oh, yes, we can, and here's the explanation, here it is, here it is, here it is. And he never responded to those. He simply just kept repeating the original arguments over and over and over. That's why that's not science. You have to respond to your colleagues. It's a social process. So, and that's the case, in my opinion, with the 9/11 conspiracy theorists who have put forth a number of claims, all of which have been responded to by professionals in the field, architects, engineers, and so on, who respond to the way claims about how the buildings fell, for example. And you don't see that in their web pages saying, oh, okay, we originally put this forth, here's the answer that they give, and so we've now solved that mystery, or we don't accept that because of this other data. You don't see any of that kind of normal back and forth that you see in any other kind of scientific debate. Just start with the biggest claims of all for 9/11 conspiracy theorists is the buildings look like they were intentionally demolished, that there were bombs placed, explosives placed up and down the World Trade Center, Twin Towers, and probably Building 7, and they were timed to go off, when the planes hit. Now, fortunately, no one disputes that planes hit the buildings, because you could hardly dispute that. But some of the wilder explanations have the planes being radio-controlled. Like a guy in another building running the plane, and there's nobody on the plane. Well, that's pretty easily refuted by the fact that the people that were on the planes in the manifest, they're gone now. So where are they? And they made cell phone calls. So who were their loved ones talking to as they were heading for the buildings? People on the planes describing it. Okay, so that's sort of an easy target. So then it goes, okay, well, maybe there were really people on the planes. And maybe they really were Al-Qaeda operatives flying the planes. Well, we know. In fact, they took training courses on how to fly a plane. They didn't seem particularly interested in taking off and landing, which should have been a clue, probably. But again, that's the hindsight bias, because who would have ever thunk that somebody would fly planes into buildings? So then it's like, okay, so if we insist that our theory hold, that the Bush administration or government was somehow involved, and we concede the point that there were really planes with real passengers flown by these Al-Qaeda operatives, well, then how do you get around that? Okay, well, they were in cahoots somehow. They had to be. Because how could you time the explosions of the building with the impact of the plane? Here we encounter a problem in logic of the what's more likely scenario, that that you have one causal vector that explains it, or two, three, multiple causal vectors that all have to be come together in the same place. A standard fallacy of cognition that all of us make is that we're comfortable with thinking of things happening in multiple causal variables, but in fact, Occam's razor says we should. The simpler explanation is the more likely one. In this case, it would be much more difficult to orchestrate the 19 hijackers and everything that they're doing with a whole separate set of causal vectors, that is, intentionally planted explosives that have to go off at a certain time. So right there, that refutes that particular one. But then you can add additional layers onto that. The buildings collapsed right where the planes impacted. That's where the failure, structural failure, began. And so that's obvious. You can just watch it on the video. So conspiracy theorists can hardly dispute that. What they say is that as you watch the buildings collapse in slow motion, and you can see all this in a Google video, you'll see little puffs of smoke come out as it's going down. Well, structural engineers know what this is. The building is collapsing. It's mostly empty space. It's the World Trade Center buildings are 95% air. The other 5% are the floors and the beams and the furniture and whatnot. So it's mostly empty space, which is why, by the way, they don't fall over that way. There's no intact structure to do that. It can only go down in that sense. And in any case, so that's just the air being pushed out. And you can see it if you watch it. The little so-called explosions coming out, puffs of smoke, are just windows being blown out, and they blow out right down as the building is coming down, exactly like structural engineers explained would happen, and as you can see in other intentionally demolished buildings. And then finally, on that particular one, they claim that the buildings did fall exactly like all intentionally demolished buildings fall. Well, this was about the easiest thing I have ever checked, thanks to Google Video and YouTube. You just go on there and type in, search, demolished buildings. You can use any number of keywords, and you'll get dozens or hundreds of buildings intentionally demolished. Every one of them falls from the bottom up, from as the explosions go up and the building comes down. And in the World Trade Center building, that isn't what happens. You don't see explosions going up and the building coming down. You see the building collapsing at the point of the impact and then falling straight down, and the puffs of smoke going down as the building goes down. So it's a complete opposite, in fact. And the claim is still made, even though we've rebutted this and anybody can check it, and yet they don't check it. And that's, I guess, what bothers me about that particular approach, is that it's a little dishonest to not do that, to not check. And even when somebody says look and then they refuse to look, then there's some duplicity there. Okay, so that's the main one they focus on, the buildings, the two twin towers. And then Building 7, World Trade Center Building 7, is the other sticking point there on the buildings. It collapsed and but it burned all day, and so they said, but how could this collapse since it it wasn't struck by a plane? Well, if you watch the footage from different angles, you can see the debris when the buildings fell striking the World Trade Center Building 7 and causing considerable structural damage. Now, conspiracy theorists will show footage of one side of the building that looks pretty pristine. There's not much going on. And what you never see is the footage on the other side of the building, which the thing is completely torched. The windows are blown out. Fire flames are coming out of it. And it really does look like it's going to go at any time. So when, at the end of the day, the fire department and the owner are standing there, and there's a team inside the building of rescue workers, and the owner says, pull it, the team. That's all he meant, was pull it, the team. Because it's probably going to collapse. And so somehow this got recorded, and this becomes a point of contention for conspiracy theory. He said, pull it, the building. He means demolish it. All the buildings were demolished. Therefore, if all the buildings were intentionally demolished, then this was an intention on the part of who? The government, the Bush administration, so on. You're off and running on just one little factoid, on one little quote that gets taken out of context. And that, too, is a very typical strategy or approach, or, to be fair, cognitive fallacy of thinking, let's say. We did a whole issue, and I wrote a whole book on the Holocaust deniers. And David Irving is the most famous of these. And this is a conspiracy theory also, that Israel and the Jewish lobby have conspired to, extract reparations out of Germany by concocting this hoax of the Holocaust. That's essentially their argument. And their argument is a very similar in approach. You find some tiny little thing that you can't explain. The main theory that you've promoted can't explain that one little thing, therefore the whole thing is false. That's the approach. I call it the fossil fallacy, as if you could debunk evolution if you could just show that this one particular fossil was a fake, as if the entire thing, entire corpus of evolutionary theory is based on one particular fossil. It's not. David Irving's approach in the case of the Holocaust is that there were no holes on the gas chamber ceiling at Crema 2 at Auschwitz-Birkenau, therefore there was no Holocaust. So you have to deconstruct that. What the hell does this guy mean? According to eyewitnesses after the war, deposed in the Nuremberg trials, SS guards climbed on top of the concrete slab of the crematoria. There were five crematoria at Auschwitz-Birkenau. So cremas 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then there was another one off. And there's actual photographs of this. You can see that the SS guards took when they were building it. And supposedly the guards got up and poured Zyklon B pellets into the holes on the gas chamber at Crema 2. That's what the eyewitnesses say. And if you go there, there's no holes in the ceiling at Crema 2 at Auschwitz-Birkenau. You can go there. I went there. You can see there's no holes. So if there were no holes, that means they weren't pouring Zyklon B pellets into the gas chamber, which means those were lies told about what happened, which means they weren't gassing anybody at Auschwitz-Birkenau, which means they weren't gassing anybody anywhere at any camp during the Second World War, which means the Nazis did not intend to exterminate European Jewry, which means this whole thing is a lie and a fake orchestrated by the Zionist lobby. And you can see it just kind of spins like this. Well, okay, I did go there, and not only are there no holes, there's no roof. It's a complete demolished rubble of concrete because the Nazis blew it up in 1945 when the Soviets were coming. They destroyed everything to cover up. Anyway, I'm telling that story simply as an example. And they have a list, the famous list of 36 things that Holocaust historians can't explain about the Holocaust, therefore it didn't happen. And they're all on that level. Like another one was the door on the gas chamber at Mauthausen. It doesn't lock. This was another one. So I went there. I took a whole trip through Europe going to all the camps to rebut these claims. What's the story with this door thing? You know, okay, so I go there, and sure enough, the door doesn't lock. I mean, it's one of these big steel doors, and there's one of those handles. You go like that, and when you go like that, the slot comes out that would go into the other part of the door like that, so you lock it. Now, presumably, you put people in there and you gas them, you know, they're going to try to get out. So you got to lock the door, right? So that's the argument. It doesn't lock, so what's the deal? So sure enough, it didn't lock. There was no slot. It just sort of banged into the thing, and so I had my buddy stand outside. I pushed it open. I had a couple people, and I could still push it open. It's like, yeah, that seems a little weird. And anyway, so I called over the little guide who didn't know, and then I called the top guide. He didn't know. And finally, I got the head of the camp. Well, camp, it's a museum now. I got the head of the museum, and he's like, why are you asking these questions? I was like, well, you know, I'm debunking those evil anti-Semitic, you know, I made it clear I wasn't like one of them, because they do show up there sometimes. You know. And just so he would give me the answer, and he didn't know, and I thought that was a little weird, frankly. I thought, gosh, has no one ever said, you know, hey, this is kind of weird about this door? The answer is no, they haven't. So anyway, I ended up on the phone with the Minister of the Interior of all of Austria. Mauthausen's in Austria, and he's like, you know, who is this? You know, you're from California. Oh, no wonder. So no, I'm not one of those Holocaust deniers. I'm just trying to find out the answer to this question. And he didn't know. Nobody knew, and I didn't find out till a couple of years later that was not the original door. The original door was shipped off to a Holocaust museum somewhere else in Europe, and they just stuck that door on there. Anyway, so... And that's pretty much that is how it goes for all 36 of their little things. But even if I couldn't answer all 36 of them, even if I couldn't answer half of them, it's largely meaningless because the whole body of evidence, say in this case of the Holocaust, points in this convergence of evidence to this conclusion, the Nazis did this. And it doesn't matter if this eyewitness exaggerated. I mean, they have a parade of these Holocaust survivors who, you know, 80 years later and are trying to remember what happened, and they've seen all the movies, and they, you know, they've inculcated and confabulated their own memories with memories of books they've read, memories of other stories of survivors they've talked to at conventions they go to, Schindler's List they've seen, and so on. All that kind of gets jumbled up in our flawed memories, and it's easy to pick apart their stories. You know, I saw Mengele standing there before me, and on this particular date, and you look it up, and Mengele wasn't there at Auschwitz on that date. Oh, they lied, which is part of the Zionist conspiracy. You're off and running. Okay, it's all like that, and that's my experience with the 9/11 conspiracy theories. It's all on that sort of this little tiny itty bitty thing that seems kind of weird, and you can't explain it. Therefore, this entire thing is fake. That simply isn't the way we can reconstruct history. It isn't how science is done. It's not how historiography is done. And so they pick at things like that, the jets were not scrambled in time to shoot down the other planes. Once we knew that the planes were hijacked, why wasn't NORAD on this? Well, you look it up, and you know there's only four places in all of the lower 48 states where there are NORAD jets on standby ready to go. Well, it's a pretty big place, and we didn't know that they were going to fly planes into buildings. After the fact, yeah, they should have shot them down right away. It would be like saying a Flight 93. Why didn't those guys charge the guy who was standing there right in the aisle? Because he had a fake, it was a fake bomb. yeah, you knew it was fake because we've all seen the movie now, but they didn't know it was fake, and no one's ever flown a plane into a building with a bunch of people in it. You hope they land, and they have their demands met so we can get off, right? So that's the... And only in hindsight do we think they should have charged the plane, which would be the same thing as saying, yeah, the Air Force should have shot him down. Yeah, okay, right, now. But that is, in any case, there wasn't enough time. I mean, to even find them, that the terrorists turned off the transponders. The plane just, boop, disappears off the radar screen. So to find it, you have to have other people in the air saying, I see him, he's over, whatever, and try to give some pinpoints. And it's hard to find planes traveling at 400 to 500 miles an hour and so on. And so, and again, it's like that. Every one of those points goes like that. And then their explanation, by the way, here's the other thing. Conspiracy theorists tend to hold us, scientists or historians, whatever, to a very high standard of evidence. And your explanation really better be quite thorough and coherent, or I'm not going to accept it. But their own theory is based on virtually no evidence at all. Like, if the buildings were intentionally demolished, the World Trade Center, we've been through all that rubble. No one has ever found a single one of those little squibs, a little explosions, one of these little intentional devices. You would find in the debris leftover parts of this. That would be positive evidence. So what their case is entirely built on is negative evidence. That is, I don't accept your explanation for X. Therefore, my explanation is right, even though I don't have any positive evidence at all in favor of it. This is yet another cognitive fallacy by pseudoscientists, in this case, the intelligent design theorists, for example. Their whole argument is based on, well, what Richard Dawkins calls the argument from personal incredulity. I don't believe it. Therefore, it's not right. Which reminds me of some of the other sort of pseudo-conspirators, more like pseudo-historians, that don't believe the Egyptians built the pyramids, and because I just can't think of how they could have done it. Well, maybe you should think about it a little harder. Or our group doesn't accept the standard theory. They use these dirt ramps or whatever the popular theory of that is now. Therefore, the Atlanteans built it, or aliens built the pyramids. You know, I mean, for gosh sakes, it's a pile of rocks. It isn't that technically sophisticated. It's hard because the rocks are heavy, but, you know, it isn't beyond the means of the technology of the day, let's put it that way. And they had a lot of free slave labor, or free, well, slaves apparently not, but cheap labor anyway. So again, the argument from personal incredulity, if I can't figure it out, it's like seeing a magic trick. I still get scientists contact us. You know, I'm a skeptic like you, but I saw Copperfield do this. He walked right through that plexiglass thing, and I don't know. I mean, is it possible he's like mixing his atoms? You know, how about this? He's a professional illusionist, and you're not. And he spends all day thinking about how to fool you, and you don't. So that's the explanation. And anyway, back to the 9/11 stuff, that's about as good as it gets, I guess. The rest, it spirals down from there. Flight 93 didn't hit it didn't crash in Pennsylvania. Because look, they couldn't find any bodies. Well, when a plane hits the ground at 600 miles an hour, actually, it was almost the speed of sound because it was nosediving. We know from lots of flight investigators what's left of humans. It's just hamburger meat. It's just tiny chunks of nothing. And so, of course, there's not going to be, you know, major body parts and so forth. And but what's their explanation? See, it's one thing to critique one theory. What's your explanation for it? And their explanation is it landed in Cleveland. Really? And where'd they go? they're in Canada somewhere, or the government gassed them is another one. Oh, we're back to the gassing. They gassed them. And I was once on G. Gordon Liddy's radio talk show for my book, Why People Believe Weird Things, and I have a section there in conspiracy theories that he wanted to ask me about. And I said, well, I ask you? I mean, you're the expert. I mean, Watergate, this is the guy, right? So I said, you know, is it possible? I mean, he said, well, not really. Complex conspiracy theories can't be true, he said. He goes, I know, because I orchestrated one. He said, there's two problems. The leakage problem and the competency problem. He said the leakage problem is people can't keep their mouth shut. If you want to keep a secret, you know, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead, right, Mark Twain? And he said the competency problem, you can picture G. Gordon Liddy, who had a rather strong ego, let's put it that way. You know, government bureaucrats are just incompetent boobs, he said. They can't hardly do anything, let alone orchestrate some incredibly complex theories. And so, I mean, not one person, I mean, think of what it would take to plant enough explosives inside both World Trade Center buildings to bring them down. This would be a major job. You know what it takes. We've all seen the shows on Discovery Channel, you know, on how they blow up buildings. It's pretty cool. But they spend, you know, weeks, months at it, you know, and they have free reign. They're in there, people know they're in there. They have free reign to do what they got to do, and it still takes weeks and months to do it and do it right. And even then, it doesn't always go right, and it's a dangerous thing. And so supposedly they were able to do this without anybody noticing that this was happening. And furthermore, it's not like the World Trade Center building is like this hotel and there's not much security around or something. The Al-Qaeda already tried to blow up the World Trade Center building in 93 with a truck bomb. So the security was pretty intense already around there. You go to New York, you go to these buildings, you have to show ID and they check your bags, all that stuff. And it's worse now, but in the World Trade Center building, you still have to do that. And nobody noticed these guys doing this. And even if somehow they were able to do that, there'd have to be a lot of people involved in orchestrating that. Not one of them wants to go on Larry King with an incredible story. Not one of them wants to write the tell-all book to explain what happened and cash in on this. Not one. And not one has done this. I mean, look what happens. Look what we've seen in just the last few years of Bush administration people who leave. What do they all do? They go on the lecture circuit. They write books. They write articles. They are on all the talk shows telling about all the little dirt and secrets and the lies and... This is small stuff compared to what we're talking about orchestrating 9/11. And even the small stuff makes huge ripples with what's-his-name's book from the Washington Post and his trilogy about the Bush taking us to war. I mean, parenthetically, it's perfectly okay to critique the Bush administration and the war. We're not talking about that. This is something way beyond that. That, of course, is legitimate. Do governments lie to their people? Well, yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean your particular conspiracy is right, though. The ufologists always make this argument to me. You know, they lied about the Roswell flying saucer. They said it was a weather balloon, and it wasn't. It was, well, we know what it was. It was this high-altitude surveillance balloon to measure acoustic anomalies in the upper atmosphere that Soviets might be testing nuclear weapons in the upper atmosphere. It's the Cold War. Of course, they're going to lie to us and say, yeah, it was a weather balloon. And, well, we lied about that. Yeah, well, okay, of course. But that doesn't mean aliens landed and they have the bodies at Area 51 and so forth. So those are two different things. Anyway, in essence, when you put it all together, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. Al-Qaeda did it. They said they did it. They're proud of it. They do it again. They've done it elsewhere in the world. They tried before. They'll try again. And why not take them at their word, since all the other evidence also points to that? Versus what's the contrary theory? And what's the more likely explanation? And it's sort of a no-brainer. And it was, for me, the investigation was more interesting from a sociological perspective. Who is doing this? And a lot of angry people about the Bush administration, which I, you know, I'm sympathetic to that, but that doesn't mean that particular theory is right. Anyway, thank you. That's my unprepared speech. Any questions or comments or, yeah, here we go.
Do you see any confirmatory bias among skeptics?
Question is there confirmatory bias in skeptics? Yes, there is. In our community, there's a strong trend, I'd say pretty emotionally strong against the paranormal and religion, probably those two things. You'll get the biggest knee-jerk response where when you hear a particular claim, you just automatically assume it can't be true. So we're subject to the same cognitive biases as everybody else. As I said, all scientists are as well. I mean, just think of the global warming debate going on now. You know, the facts don't just speak for themselves. They don't. These are really complex models, and you have to interpret the data through the models. And you can spin those models since the data's there's so many causal vectors in there, it really is hard to control from all. you can really spin it one way or the other. It's pretty easy to do. I think now the convergence of evidence is leaning pretty strongly toward anthropogenic global warming as being real. That is, we're causing a good portion of it, maybe not all of it. But I think it's taken a long time, probably 30 years of data collection and more sophisticated computer modeling to get to the point where we can, with reasonable confidence, say this is probably the case. And that's kind of how science goes. But still, you know, there are hangouts who are holdouts, and people would accuse people like Al Gore of being completely biased, going too far, and I agree. Sometimes they go too far.
About that, I had a Georgia U.S. congressman announce to a room full of middle schoolers on Tuesday that global warming had nothing to do with people on the planet, that it was just the natural cycle of the Earth.
Yeah.
U.S. congressman.
Yep. Oh, Georgia. Yeah. He's probably a Republican, maybe.
This is about the 9/11 World Trade Center. We're explained most everything, but how come the center can support spires of the building? None of them were standing. If the reason for the collapse was the plane crash and the floors falling,
you're talking about these, so it would go around and leave them standing there. I'm not sure technically on that. I mean, they melted, not melted. This is another thing. They weakened enough to collapse. Okay, my column I did for Scientific American was called Fahrenheit 2777, inspired by Michael Moore. Anyway, that steel melts at 2700 degrees Fahrenheit, and jet fuel burns at 1500 degrees. This is another one of these no holes, no holocaust. You know. How do you explain that? Well, because it doesn't have to get to 2700 degrees. It only has to get to about 1400 degrees, something like that, to weaken at 50% of its strength. And then you just bend in the collapse, and you get a cascading effect once the first bolt goes, and then the first floor, and then and look where they hit. I mean, there wasn't just one floor; you got the whole stack above them.
I think you just touched on what I was going to say. It's a structure. My structural mechanics is a few years behind me, but take out enough pieces, and the rest will collapse. The central piers are pretty secure, but are not designed to stand on their own with material falling around them.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, that sounds right.
I don't believe in almost all conspiracy theories because I don't think anyone can keep their mouth shut, and certainly not 100 people or more. So the question all my conspiracy theory distinguished friends always point to is, well, the media is owned by, you know, big companies. I heard this about the voter fraud. I heard this about 9/11. I just keep hearing, oh, well, the media companies control the news. And I personally don't believe it, but I mean, because the reporters are just dying to for a scoop. So maybe you can fill in the gaps there.
Yeah, we do deal a lot with media questions about that because, well, there is a media bias somewhat, and it's true. I mean, the major networks are owned by giant corporations. However, I don't worry about it because most people get their news from The Daily Show and the Colbert Report now. So so who cares what CBS says? I mean, there are enough other avenues for news. Heck, I think most of us, by the time the evening news comes on, I pretty much know everything that's happened just on the internet, just surfing around doing general stuff. And that's how most of us get it now. I don't really think we have to worry about it. I mean, it's there. It's something to be concerned about. But there's so many end runs around potential bias. I mean, there is a liberal bias in some networks, it's true. But there's a conservative bias in talk radio, for example. And so you just kind of do the checks and balances. And there's enough stuff going on. There's enough sources that I don't think we have too much to worry about.
You actually have two former reporters who actually did work for the New York Times Company, and I've never gotten a memo from anybody saying to hold news, or I've never gotten a memo from somebody saying don't report something, and I can sure as hell tell you that if somebody had a tip on some kind of conspiracy like that, we'd be all over that.
Oh yeah,
because we live in a competitive environment. And God knows if the Washington Post or somebody else were to get something like that.
Oh, you'd be in trouble,
you know,
yeah.
Not only would we feel bad, but our bosses would probably hang us. So had to throw those two cents.
No, thank you. That's right. I think it is competitive. That's why competition is good like that.
Liberal bias, that's a whole other conspiracy theory. So.
Well, there's been some studies done. I realize the data is conflicting on that. I guess the New York Times is not as liberal as in the last study as people have accused it of being. Although that same study showed that Fox was not as right-slanting as people thought. which I find hard to believe too. But I mean, I'm a libertarian, so I critique both sides. Okay. There's three of us now.
Has your publication done anything to about the big conspiracy theory of weapons of mass destruction?
Well, no, I haven't done anything on that, simply because everybody else who has tons more money than I have looked into that. I mean, all the networks and all the major newspapers and so on. And I think it was pretty obvious. I mean, the first time I heard that argument that we can't find them, therefore they exist and they moved them. And I remember the ufologist saying, because I said, where's the bodies? Where are the spacecraft? Where's the evidence? They said, well, we know that they exist because they hide them. It's the same argument. And so, yeah, I think obviously that's, yeah, it's. I think most of us would probably agree that was not the right reason to go to war in Iraq. I mean, maybe he had them before. It's true. So maybe he did move them, but I don't know.
I just had two things to say. First of all, I had a question about the missile theory for the Pentagon, you know, that it wasn't the plane that hit, it was the missile. And the other thing I wanted to bring up was, you know, about the confirmation bias here, you know, about people not being able to keep secrets. I mean, you know, certainly there's a lot of secrecy in our government, and a lot of people take, you know, sworn to secrecy, to, you know, have security clearances and so forth. I think that's all well and good as long as the people who have that and who are doing clandestine things believe that, you know, believe in what they're doing, right? I mean, they're probably not going to go break those oaths, you know, as long as that's true. I think it's kind of hard to say whether that would be true for, you know, blowing up the World Trade Center and killing thousands of Americans, whether how many Americans you could convince to go along with something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, with like, you know, what about people, you know, using spying on Americans illegally or whatever. And stuff like that. I mean, there's certainly some evidence that that's going on.
And that's a conspiracy of sorts.
Yeah, you know, but of course there's some positive evidence there too, you know. Well, sort of.
And we find out about it.
And we eventually probably will find out about it, but... Anyway, that's all.
Yeah. Well, no, it's true. But even so, those security breaches do happen, and the security clearances, those have to be renewed, and you know, you have to really be vigilant to keep their mouth shut. It's hard to do, and that's like top high end, you know, fairly people planting bombs. I mean, I don't know, it just seems unlikely. Although I was surprised, I have to say, after reading Ben Rich's book on the development of the U-2 spy plane, the Skunk Works is in Burbank, which is in LA. I mean, they were doing all this and none of us knew about it for decades. So still, that's just one little, you know, experimental aircraft. It's hardly a huge thing like 9/11.
Anyway. You're in the profession of debunking conspiracy theories. In your investigations, have you ever investigated a conspiracy theory that you found to be plausible or true or anything like that?
Well, I back to the weapons of mass destruction, I have to say there's probably has been a lot of stuff going on in the Bush administration, 9/11 aside, that we probably won't know about for years to come, that are probably going to be fairly serious. That by definition is a type of conspiracy. I mean, there are elected officials, and it's sort of an iffy gray area about how much they're supposed to do on their own without our approval, and so on. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of that. I used to be really quite open to the idea of Kennedy being there was a conspiracy with the JFK thing. And I sort of fell into the trap after the Oliver Stone movie. Like, gosh darn it, I know this guy's pulling, yanking my chain here. But if only half of this is right, or if only 10% of it, then there had to be a second shooter. I sort of fell into that trap. And then I read Gerald Posner's book, Case Closed, which really is the best book on this subject. I know Vince Bugliosi has a new book out, but it's like 1,600 pages long. So Posner's book just gets right to the point. And he shoots down every single one of the claims by the JFK, including everything in Oliver Stone's. Oliver Stone is just lies. He's just a liar. He has got this scene with Walter Matthau, one of the other characters, talking about Lee Harvey Oswald's army record for shooting for accuracy with the rifle, riflery. And, you know, he missed everything. He missed the target. Couldn't even hit the target. Shot Maggie's drawers, right? Well, we actually have the targets. And Posner chased down his record. He was a sharpshooter. He could shoot in the bullseye, like 5 out of 6 bullets, from 300 yards away. He shot Kennedy from 120, 130 yards away. That's not a hard shot to make for somebody who has that skill, and he had that skill. So that's, the movie is filled with that, just complete lies, and it's too bad because he's a good filmmaker. And and Posner did that. Like, there was another one, yet another fallacy of conspiracy thinking. The role of chance in life is far grander than most of us realize. Our brains are designed, evolved, to, sorry, trying to get around that word, designed by evolution to find patterns and connect the dots. A is connected to B and so on, and that's called learning, association learning, and we're really good at it. What we don't have is a module to detect false positives. So we make false positives all the time, but usually they don't get you killed, so you're still in the gene pool and it gets passed along. But we're very uncomfortable with uncertainties. It's much easier to just find a pattern and make it fit. And all the cognitive studies show how well we do this. And there's a good book now out called Black Swan by Nassim Taleb, about the role of chance in markets and life and so on, the unpredictability of the stock market and so on. Little chancy things that no one could ever predict actually have huge consequences. Well, in the case of JFK, they make a big deal about the fact that Oswald got a job at the Book Depository building right on the route that Kennedy was going by. Come on, what are the chances of that? Well, low, but in fact, if you do what Posner did, you track down when he got the job and when the parade route was picked. He got the job months before the parade route was picked. It was just chance. He got lucky. And a lot of times, that kind of thing happens.
The only other thing I've ever wondered was the magic bullet theory. How did he explain that?
That it isn't required. That the bullet wasn't doing one of these, you know, things like in the Oliver Stone movie. That it, from the particular angle it was, you can just, this has now been reconstructed. Even the Mythbusters did this one. Yeah. And it can easily explain exactly that trajectory.
Yeah. Question back to the missiles. How can you debunk that? Because I've got plenty of friends who are convinced, number one, a missile hit the Pentagon.
Oh.
Number two, a missile took out flight number 3. And then a very a not-so-recent one, flight TWA-800 from the Atlanta Olympics. There's also still people saying, oh, this was taken out by a missile. When I can't convince them otherwise.
Right, yeah. Well, on the Pentagon one, that's really a simple one. There were hundreds of people who were standing around who saw an American Airlines plane hit it. Well, I mean, one or two people maybe can sort of blur out or hallucinate or, you know, mistakenly perceive something. But, and even better than that, there's pieces of the American Airlines plane sitting there on the ground. There's a great shot of that. You can go on our webpage, skeptic.com, we have it there. I think we have it in our article on that. And Popular Mechanics has a picture of it. And it's in color. You can see the American Airlines paint. It's right there on the lawn. Planted by operatives of the Bush administration. And then I haven't heard that one. All I've heard about is the mysterious white jet that was flying over it, which turned out to be explained that when the air traffic controllers, when they turned off the transponder and they couldn't find the plane, they found somebody who was in a private jet who was nearby and said, go fly around and see if you can see this thing. And they said, yeah, we see it. It's going that way. Okay, follow it. That was the mysterious white plane that supposedly shot it down. I think that's the missile you're talking about. And then Flight 800, I don't know the conspiracy on that one. I know what the FTAs, whichever group that investigates air accidents, that it was an empty gas tank with fumes in it that exploded. But I do know, I remember vaguely, because I haven't really looked into this in a long time, that some eyewitnesses said they thought they saw a missile, something like that. But anyway, that's all I know about that.
If you look at, if you completely discard that 9/11 was a conspiratorial event concerning the government, but if you look at who benefits, and if you look at the history of the Project for the New American Century and the Iraq Study Group, and the corporate entities who write 95% of our legislation, and you seem to not saying that they didn't plan it, but the fact that it happened turned out to be positive for a lot of corporate America.
Well, sure. Governments certainly use chance events or things that happen to their advantage. It was pretty clear that Roosevelt wanted us to be in the war to help England, and it was clear there were threats, but you have to sort of wait for the right moment. Well, the moment came along. He didn't plan it, but well, given that opportunity, let's do it. Let's roll.
Exxon benefited from Katrina.
Perfect, yeah, example. So, yeah, of course, corporations and governments will take advantage of things.
Another take on that is it's not so much who did benefit as who was likely to benefit. To accept that as a reason for conspiracy, one would have to assume that Bush would be reelected, for example, that other people would not be elected at some point. Yes, many people did benefit. The assassination of Kennedy gives even better examples. Yes, there were people who benefited from that, but there's no easy way to show that they were more likely to benefit from that than from any other event on that day.
Oh, yeah, your point is the hindsight bias. In hindsight, we see that they benefited, but at the time, it would not have been clear. Yeah, good. Well said. He's got one there.
I just want to ask, you were talking about the, for instance, the building that's pristine on one side and the back is damaged. I would assume that the people posting the video in these conspiracies, they know that the back looks like that. Is it?
I would hope so, but...
Are they ignoring it, or they want to... You know, they watched All the President's Men when they were little, and they got to look for conspiracy. I mean, what's driving these people to do this, even if they... Did they just mind block it out, or did they're trying to... you know, they know it's false, but they want to gain, you know, fame or something. What do you think is driving
them?
It's a conspiracy.
Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, it's a part of a mindset that once you start down the road, you probably come to believe it yourself. My friend Phil Zimbardo, the guy that did the famous Stanford Prison experiments, he says no one joins a cult. They join a group that they think is a good cause. They're doing a good thing. And, you know, step by step by step, it's like in Milgram shock experiments. No one's going to throw 450 volts, but 15 volts, that's not so bad. Another 30 and then 45, and pretty soon you're up there. But, you know, step by step, it doesn't seem so bad. So you go down the road of sort of having a little fun, making a fun movie, and pretty soon, you know, hey, man, your own confirmation bias kicks in. It's the way psychics work. I think most of them are probably not consciously fraudulent about it, bilking people out of their money, knowing that they're playing a scam, doing cold readings or whatever. I think they come to believe they really have psychic abilities because people tell them they do. You know, and they remember their own hits and forget their own misses, and their clients, you know, give them money and say, "You're incredible. I mean, wow, you told me this and that, and my life is so much better." And they think, "Wow, maybe I do." Again, gradually over time, they come to believe it. David Koresh probably really did think he was talking to God.
Yeah, I get a lot of these back channel emails about a lot of these conspiracies seem to come from these chain letters of, you know, I heard this from some guy who was a friend of a friend. I have two questions. First of all, my first question is, how often do you think that these things, that there might actually be a conspiracy behind the conspiracy, which is to say that some of these email chains are deliberately created by a group, possibly for example, political purposes, to inflame a group of the population? And the second question I have is, if that's the case, are there any specific tools besides, like, for example, Snopes.com, that you can, like, a central database where that you can immediately shoot down a lot of these kinds of things?
If you don't know Snopes.com, they're sort of the best on urban legends and myths, things like that. And, well, that is the way. I mean, right? We just counter bad ideas with good ideas, and in a free society, that's all we can do. I think the answer to your question about these chain emails, I think it's more of a self-organized, emergent, bottom-up thing. It just happens, like a mass hysteria sort of thing. It just gets passed along. There are people that do mass write-ins. You know, they'll email all their constituents and say, everybody send a letter to Senator so-and-so, or in my case, they'll send me letters, or to Scientific American in particular. And it's really obvious because they all say the exact same thing, in the same wording, same sentences. You know, and it's like you just start deleting them because they're just copying and pasting a letter. And so those are kind of obvious, but those are slightly different than what that's usually a targeted letter writing campaign, slightly different than, I think, orchestrating. Well, that in ufology, that's what is that called? An agent of disinformation. I've been accused of being an agent of disinformation, working for the U.S. government to be a skeptic only to misdirect people from the truth.
Because you're clearly such a fan of.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I haven't got any checks. I haven't been paid for this yet, though. So nor am I. I'm into conspiracy.
How do conspiracy theories ever die, or when do they? Do you have an example of something from the past that has filtered out of a consciousness in the society?
Well, I think they mostly die a slow death, like the Pearl Harbor stuff largely fell into disuse. It was just lack of interest because there were no more new smoking guns. Or like a new book comes out like that I mentioned in 94, that book came out. And it was thoroughly reviewed and critiqued and debunked by professional historians. And that was the end of that. We never heard about that conspiracy again. So that's usually what happens.
That doesn't always happen, though. Give you a simple example. Take Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Mm. You can find on the internet now the complete text of the original French book that the Russian book was plagiarized from.
Right.
Which was I forget who it was originally about, but it was done by was rewritten by the intelligence offices under Catherine the Great. This. Someone's trying to silence this.
Yes, that's a good example.
It can be absolutely proven that the original text,
yeah,
50 years older,
yes,
is out there.
And yet it's still floating around, yeah.
Yeah. I've actually seen it handed out on the street corners.
Yeah, no, you're right. In fact, when I mentioned the Holocaust deniers, their headquarters are in Southern California, so I drove down there and visited them, spent quite a bit of time there. Their number one best-selling book, they have a book catalog, is the Elders of Zion. That's their top seller. People buy it.
And the original French that the Russians plagiarized from is not known in most
places. Right, yeah.
It's pretty well known among skeptics and so on in the U.S. that exists.
Yeah, no, you're right. They do come back like a virus. Well, Holocaust denial is popular again in Turkey and some of the Middle Eastern countries for obvious reasons. Okay, so I guess we have to. Are we done here at 3:30? We're supposed to leave, or
we can go on for a few more minutes.
Okay, we've got one more question.
10 more minutes.
Okay.
Any more?
Or not? Well, I'll be hanging out at my booth just right down the hall here. Thank you so much.